Every day, more than 815 million people around the world go hungry. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, Fighting Hunger in a Changing World. Catherine Bertini has spent her life on the front lines of the fight to end world hunger, running the United Nations World Food Program for 10 years. In 2003, she was named the World Food Prize Laureate. Bertini spoke at the Dole Institute of Politics on October 4, 2017, co-sponsored by the KU Center for Sustainability, Kansas Appleseed, and Just Food. This event was moderated by Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute.
Kathy, welcome to the Dole Institute and the University of Kansas. It's great to see you again after a long period of time. What would you say, if you had to point to one or two accomplishments while you were running the World Food Program, what would you say were the things that you're most proud of today?
Well, building the organization or rebuilding the organization at every level while it was running was why I won the World Food Prize in 2003, because the organization was recognized to be the efficient, effective organization it was. At the same time, another thing they said in the citation that year was the highlight, the emphasis that we put on women. And so maybe I could tell you a little bit about that. When we developed a mission statement, it was a long mission. It started out being two paragraphs and ended up being two pages, single spaced. Just everybody had to put in their 2 cents in our governing body. But ultimately, the mission was to end hunger. Now, one time somebody said, "End hunger? How can you possibly end hunger?" And I said, "Well, you know, with the people we reach, we're going to end hunger." Well, yeah, if it could be, hunger could be totally solved by one organization, it would be gone. But that's our mission in the areas in which we decide to work. And once we defined that our mission was to end hunger, then the next issue was, well, how are we going to do that? Just moving food from the port in Louisiana to the port in Djibouti so that we can truck it into Ethiopia, then what? And the answer was really around, well, who's ultimately going to cook the food that is served to people that can end their hunger? And the answer is women. They were the cooks, the wives, the mothers, the aunts, the grandmothers, the daughters. And so we had to find ways to partner with the cooks, who happened to be women. And when you think about that, then any kind of developmental program, you have to interact with the people that you think you're going to serve. Because if you just say, oh, I know what they need, I mean, that's the way to waste a lot of money and time and effort. In this case, food. So you really have to get feedback about what people think they really need and then try to provide it. So women aren't necessarily in leadership positions much, and we had to find ways to hear from women. And we did that a lot of different methods. For instance, in South Sudan, where we were, and unfortunately WFP still is, dropping food out of the back of airplanes, where big C-130s, cargo aircraft go over a football field size area and drop food out of the back. We would send staff in ahead of time to organize this with each village. And when we met with the chiefs, we would make arrangements with them to have committees of villagers to decide who was going to be able to line up for food at any given delivery point, because there was never enough. And so if there was a committee, they could do that, but we insisted that the committee be at least 50% female. So if there were 15 members of the committee, 8 at least had to be women. And when in Afghanistan, when the Taliban came into power and sent these edicts that women couldn't work, women couldn't go out of the house without a male relative, and girls couldn't go to school, UNICEF and WFP said, well, then we're not going to send any more food to the schools. And the Taliban said, yeah, but the boys are important. And we said, yes, they are, just as important as the girls. So we don't care whether they're in co-ed schools or not. If you want to set up separate schools, then we'll send food both places. No, so we didn't. But we did keep life-saving programming alive. But we had some very brave female staff members in Afghanistan who went to see the Taliban in leadership in 7 different cities and told them that, politely, that if their policies came to fruition, that they would be the cause of widows dying at home because they had nobody to take them out. They couldn't work. So how are they going to get food? And we have a solution, by the way. Our solution is, if you allow us to run bakeries, us, the World Food Program, we could have women running those bakeries and widows could come and get bread every day. And that's what happened, and it lasted for years, actually, after that. In Latin America, we worked with mothers' clubs, and we just organized as many schemes as possible in order to reach women. So then you take the next level down. Well, if we're going to reach women, we have to have enough women on our own staff to be able to talk to women. So many cultures, you know, if you and I went together, you couldn't sit down and talk to the women in rural India, for instance. So we had to increase our numbers of staff. When I got there, we had 17% female professionals, 17% female professionals. And when I asked my senior colleagues, all of whom were men, why that was true, they said, well, we do guy things here. And I said, well, what are guy things? Well, trucks and trains and planes and ships. And I said, why, I bet if we tried, we probably could find women to work in some of those careers. So we worked on it, but until it was part of our mission, you see, when it became part of the business plan, essentially, then people got it. Oh, yeah, we need more women because they need to talk to women. It wasn't so controversial anymore. It wasn't like the women were taking up space that could be held by men because we needed the women, too. And then, to take it a step further, just to make sure, I put it in, I said anybody who's a hiring manager needs to have as one of his or her objectives for the year, hiring 50% female. They would be doing an adequate job at that. Point. So then we got up to 39% by the time I left, and at least enough of a critical mass. So that's a long answer to your question, but modernizing the organization and bringing in women.
That was a very good answer. You mentioned winning the World Food Prize. What was that like?
Did you see the guy on television just recently who was called by the Nobel Committee to say he was at Rockefeller University, and he was called to say that he won the Nobel Prize in physics, I think, and he said, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't put my, just a couple days ago, he said, I couldn't put my shoes on because I then remembered, oh, I have to put my socks on. And then I remembered, oh, I have to put my pants on. And so I really got a kick out of that because you don't know what to do when they call you with this kind of call. I mean, what? Me? I remember exactly where I was and talking to them about it. And it was, yeah, totally, totally amazing.
How big is the hunger problem today, and what progress have we made on that?
The good news is that we've made really good progress, we collectively. There are fewer desperately hungry people in the world today than there were 10 years ago. And the reason is primarily because of economic development. Because people are better off, there are less people who are desperately hungry. The Food and Agriculture Organization, that group in Rome that does research, says right now, their September 2017 statistics are that there are 815 million hungry people. 10 years ago, the number was about 850. Last year, however, it was lower than it is now. There are two reasons. One is because of so many different climatic eruptions, and two is so many long-standing crises. think Syria, for instance, and how many people are living in crisis in Syria or refugees outside of Syria for so many years. There's so many more people living for so long in these crises that it means that there are more people who are hungry. Although the vast majority of that 815 million people are hungry because they're poor. So the good news is while population has been increasing, the numbers of hungry people generally have been decreasing. That's the good news. Still an unconscionable number, but it's good work in progress. Big issue now is becoming obesity. I mean, we know that here, but it's not just a problem in wealthy countries, it's also a problem in poor countries. There are almost as many on a percentage basis obese people in China and India, for instance, as there are in the US. And obesity is also sometimes a function of poverty, because if you don't have enough money to buy enough of a variety of foods, then you might buy a lot of bulk. So whether it's potatoes or rice or bread, you may be eating mostly starch and not to fill your stomach, but not enough protein and not enough balance. So obesity is not just because of wealthier Americans sitting in front of our television sets and pushing the button, the channel changer, and not exercising, which is also an issue, but it's a problem with a basic diet as well. And it's becoming a real serious problem for not only healthcare systems, but also for budgets and also for the availability of workers in a lot of areas. So now, you know, the word malnutrition, we used to use that word and mean the desperately hungry, scrawny baby. Now, mal, though, means bad, right? So it's now really used by nutritionists as being both under and over nutrition.
What would you say, Kathy, were the biggest challenges to resolving world hunger?
Well, economic development is what's helping, so I would say more investment in more rural areas and in more poor areas is really important. And more private sector involvement especially important. And think about our own development as a nation, where our base was an agricultural base. And same for Europe, same for Australia, same for Canada. And now, agriculture is a very important, but a much smaller part of our own economy. So think in an African country, for instance, where agriculture is still the prime industry. And same concept will work. If we can invest more in agriculture to help farmers become not only more productive, but have more income, then there'll be more investments, and then those countries will be able to move beyond the basic poverty that hits so many people. So the investments in agriculture development, not just what the U.S. government might do or what grants the Gates Foundation might give, but real private sector investment is important. And that's also in processing. A lot of times there are a lot of crops grown, but then they're shipped out of the country for processing, come back at a much higher cost for the people that live in the country. So a lot of the investment could be right in the country with processing and with buying more locally. So economic development is a number one, but these long-term crises, when are we going to have world political leadership that's going to say, okay, we're going to stop this war in Syria. We're going to work with the Nigerians to bring peace in northern Nigeria, where there's both a famine and in a very unsafe place to live. Same in Yemen, same in South Sudan. And so these long-term crises need to be solved not by short-term solutions, which are all we have right now, but by having them be higher on the priority list of the important powers in the world.
We have a number of people here tonight who are involved in the fight against hunger, and probably a lot of young people who are interested in being part of that. What's the best way for those folks to, what's the best advice you have for them in terms of being active in this cause?
There are all sorts of ways to be active, starting with, if you don't do anything else, writing to your member of Congress and to your senators to tell them how important supporting anti-hunger efforts are. But in saying that, I have to say that Kansas has such a long tradition of supporting this work that it's an easy letter to write because it'll be well appreciated on the other side. I mean, Senator Roberts has been really strong in support of the agriculture development and food issues, and Senator Moran has been also a kind of a relatively new voice on in terms of global development. So, and they follow in the long tradition started by Senator Dole in this regard. By the way, a quick story about Senator Roberts. At one point in the Bush W administration, USAID said it wanted to take over the McGovern-Dole program, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. And so it's currently being run by U.S. Department of Agriculture. So USAID, they put it in the budget. The administration put in the budget that USAID should manage it. And somebody from the White House, I don't know who, and Senator never said who, he called to say he didn't know if this was a good idea. Senator Roberts called this guy. And the guy said, send me a letter.
Ooh.
So Senator Roberts sent him a letter with 100 senators signing the letter saying, don't move McGovern-Dole from USDA to USAID. And it's still at USDA. Yeah. Anyway, number one, write to your senator. So even though you know you have good ones, write to them and tell them how important this is and your members of Congress. That's always number one. Write to the president and tell him, too. Then I would, and everybody can do that. If people want to volunteer, I know there are people in the audience, we met some of them at dinner, who work on supporting children in summers. Think about children, poor children who don't have enough to eat at home to begin with, who get to school in part so they can eat. But in the summer, then what do? So there's summer programs that are really important. The food banking system is really important, and I know there's people from food banking here as well. Especially, it helps people get over a bridge when they're having trouble. So there's things you can do right now. If you want to look for a career in this kind of work in humanitarian affairs, for instance, at a big NGO or at the UN, then you need some experience in the field, whether it's Peace Corps or another NGO or through some other work. You need a master's degree in a relevant field, and you need languages. We used to have a lot easier time at WFP hiring Canadians than we did Americans because most of them come bilingual, and the Americans mostly don't. And certainly the Europeans mostly have multiple languages, so that's the competition. So if somebody says, yeah, but I'm really good, I have this degree in food science, and I can, yeah, but if you're not competitive if you can't speak multiple languages and be moved or eligible to be moved to a lot of different countries. But then also we can donate, and there's all sorts of places to donate locally, but also internationally. And again, based on the interest of some of the students and others we met earlier, I want to tell you about two organizations that are really fairly new and pretty interesting. And both of them do a lot of capacity building. And when we think about a lot of the work in developing countries and in countries around the world, capacity building is really important. So one of them is school lunch capacity building. It's called the Global Child Nutrition Foundation. And what they do is train people on how to run school lunch programs. And they're fairly new, but they've already had a lot of success with training people all around the world, and they become very popular in that kind of small niche of operations. The other is the Global Food Banking Network. Same idea. What works in Lawrence in the food bank might also work in Hong Kong, and it might also work in Pretoria. So they bring together people who are interested in food banking in different places, the same idea of that kind of capacity building. So those are two new-ish organizations, both run by really amazing women, and both U.S.-based, that somebody could consider. And then finally, when I decided when I was at WFP that the single most important thing to do in the world was to educate girls, because if girls are educated, they change the whole community for the better. They get better jobs, their children are more likely to go to school, they are less likely to die in childbirth or to have their children die young, they know more about health care, they're less likely to have AIDS, because if they're in school long enough, they're more likely to marry somebody closer to their old age, their own age, as opposed to being married off to somebody older who's more likely to bring AIDS to the family. They have half as many children as their sisters who are not married, because they know more about baby spacing and because they're older when they start having children. It's just the most important thing, I think, in the world to do to really impact upon development. So I always try to encourage people to get involved in that. When I won the World Food Prize, there's $250,000 that comes with the World Food Prize, and I asked that to be put into a fund for girls' education. We've raised more money. We give out small grants to NGOs working on this around the world. I think it's absolutely critically important, and there are a lot of great organizations that work in this space.
Okay. I have one final question, Kathy, is talk a little bit about, let me say this. I think Senator Dole considers nutrition and agriculture a critical part of his legacy. What is Bob Dole's legacy on nutrition?
Well, I couldn't wait to talk about this topic because it's so exciting to be here in this beautiful facility that's dedicated to the missions of Senator Bob Dole. And when he was honored with a Congressional Medal recently, in fact, I wrote to Bill about how amazingly important that was because of the legacy that the senator has. So I'm so honored to be here to be able to recognize that legacy. I'm sure that many of you have heard him tell stories about how his Midwestern upbringing and how his service in World War II impacted his sensitivity, he wouldn't necessarily use that word, but to these issues and to his understanding and to his commitment. He is never failing in being front and center on pushing programs to help feed hungry people, whether it's hungry people in the United States or overseas, whether it's children or the elderly. He has totally been in the forefront of these programs. He and his partner, George McGovern, and others, but the two of them were both on the Agriculture Committee, and so they both worked together hand in hand in a bipartisan basis with many others. And I'll give you a few examples. Food stamps used to be, first of all, not national, and second of all, you used to have to pay in order to get them. And you would pay like $4 to get $6 worth of food stamps. And he and Senator McGovern started having, I think McGovern was the initiator of a Senate Hunger Caucus. And the Hunger Caucus, and Dole quickly signed up, and they started to have field hearings. And the senator says it was during those field hearings that he could see the terrible state of hunger in the United States of America, and when he knew he had to do something about it. And then he remembered his own experiences, and he said he was the county attorney in Russell County, mm-hmm. signing welfare checks, including to three of his own grandparents. So he knew from his family experience. He and George would both talk about what they saw during the war, the poor kids post-war, during the war in Italy and elsewhere. So he was really motivated by all of that and really did not think this was a partisan issue at all. He was the leader of the Senate for some of this time, saying this is, I mean, the Republican leader of the Senate saying this is important, we're going to do it. And he did. So when food stamps, they put a proposal together, I believe in 1976, in order to nationalize food stamps and to have people not have to pay for them. Imagine if you don't have any money, you can't even afford to pay for the food stamps, so you aren't going to get any food. So they put a bill together, I think it was in 1976, and the Ford administration didn't endorse it, but the Carter administration did. So in 1977, actually 40 years ago this past Friday, that bill was signed into law, the Food Stamp Act, and to be able to nationalize the program and take the cash requirement out of it. And although that's the modern day program that he really created and felt very strongly about doing so. When we think about a school lunch and breakfast, we know about some of the same stories, because it used to be school lunch started right after World War II, actually, because the recruiters said that so many children, so many young men couldn't pass the draft physical because they were emaciated. And so in 1946, they actually started serving milk. Does anybody remember getting milk in school? They've served milk in school. And then they had school lunches in some places, but it wasn't national, and it cost money. And again, Dolan McGovern saw some of the feedback about this program and saw children who couldn't afford to buy the lunch at school. And they said, well, we've got to do something about this. And so they did. And they made the National School Lunch Act. And then they put in breakfast. And now, you know, if you have a certain percentage of poor children in school, you get the breakfast for free for everybody. They had to deal with other issues like the stigma issues of, you know, you get a free lunch, you don't, and how does that work? Because then sometimes poor kids don't go sign up because it looks like only the poor kids eat. There's so many other issues to deal with when you think about school lunch and breakfast. But it's so important because when children eat, especially that morning meal, they do better on standardized tests, they do better overall in school, they have a lower absentee rates, they have lower tardiness rates, and it makes all the difference. They pay attention in class, the teachers will tell you. So it's just really important. And then there was the Women, Infants, and Children program, the WIC program, and the ribbon was cut on WIC in 1974. Clayton Yoder, Assistant Secretary at USDA, cut the ribbon, the Nixon administration. And another important initiative of these two gentlemen to push for programming food for poor women who were pregnant and had toddlers, infants and toddlers. So then if you think internationally, they're both really committed to doing this international work. And so they teamed up again, Senator Dole and Senator McGovern. Of course, Senator Dole and Senator Roberts say that it's the Dole-McGovern school feeding program. George McGovern was the ambassador in Rome under Clinton to the UN in Rome. And so, because he kind of came full circle, because he went to Rome and created the World Food Program, then he did those other things, then he comes back as the ambassador to those programs in Rome. And so he talked to Senator Dole and said, why don't we have a program where every child in the world can have lunch at school? And Dole said, I'm for that. What do we do about it? So they went to see Bill Clinton, the president. And by the way, in 1972, Bill Clinton was the Texas campaign coordinator for the McGovern campaign. So they went to see the president, and he said, well, what can I do about it? And they said, you've got surplus. Give us 300,000 tons of surplus to get the program off the ground. And that's what happened for the International School Feeding Program. And that exists today because, again, they got legislation that wasn't just an initiative of the president. It's not as big as it was then, but it's another thing you could ask your members of Congress to support. And so that was part of his legacy and part of one of the reasons why the two of them won the World Food Prize. And when they did, it was such a special time. It was 2008. And they did a program like this, Bill, that I moderated in Des Moines. People came out of the woodwork to this place. I mean, Des Moines, Iowa. They had been campaigning for one of these two guys forever. And so it was jammed. Everybody that came to hear Senator Dole and Senator McGovern, of course, well, they're both pretty funny, but Senator Dole really kind of knocks you over with his humor. And like he said something like, well, mind you, they were there because they won the World Food Prize. Well, here you are with two losers. But now we've won. And winning really was an acknowledgement of this amazing work that they did as leaders in the U.S. and leaders in the world to ensure that people all over the world are fed. So it's an amazing legacy. It's really important. There are some really nice videos, Bill, that I want to be sure that the Dole Institute has interviewing Senator Dole about some of his work, especially on the 30th and now the 40th anniversaries of the Food Stamp Act.
You're listening to Catherine Bertini, winner of the 2003 World Food Prize for her work in fighting world hunger. We'll have more of her October 4th, 2017 talk at KU's Dole Institute of Politics right after this.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monroe,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen every day, weekdays from 5 to 9 a.m. on Kansas public radio stations.
You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Support for KPR Presents comes from Theodore Lawrence presenting Camelot, the magic and shining moment of young King Arthur's kingdom, playing weekends June 8th through June 24th. Tickets at theodorelawrence.com. I do hope you'll join us down at Lawrence's South Park on Thursday, June 21st. It's KPR's second annual Ice Cream Social. Join us for some free ice cream from Silas and Maddie's, iced coffee from Alchemy, and live music by Bongotini. And the first 200 KPR members get their ice cream in a brand new KPR mug. So join us Thursday evening, June 21st, 5 to 7 p.m. See you there. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Today on KPR Presents, Fighting Hunger in a Changing World. It's Catherine Bertini, winner of the World Food Prize for her work battling hunger around the world.
Let's open it up to your questions. So raise your hand and they'll come around, and we have one right over here.
Thank you for the wonderful discussion. As you, I'm sure you're well aware, plant scientists and other world leaders are becoming increasingly concerned about climate change effects on plant productivity and stress that would be coupled with growing world population. And I certainly know that the Gates Foundation's been funding innovations in photosynthesis to try to address that at the basic science level. But are you concerned about that issue? And if so, do you think we can get ahead of that in development, basic science, and use that as a way to get ahead of this? And I'm particularly concerned about climate change effects in some of the most poverty-stricken regions of the world. I realize some areas won't be as worse off as some of those places for this issue.
It's a very, very important issue to deal with all of the different climatic changes and to be able to adapt agriculture accordingly. And if you add on to the changes in the climate, if you add on to the fact that adoption of new crops is difficult anyway, and the lack of people's income, having enough income and ability to even to invest properly, it's kind of layer upon layer upon layer of problems, and it you know, has to be peeled back carefully. There are a lot of, you know, when anybody here who's been in farming in Kansas knows that extension agents, especially years ago, were critically important to the development of our agriculture. Well, we have to think more creatively in the developing world about how to give advice, like we used to get from extension here, but how to give advice about all of these changing issues in different developing countries around the world. And because, first of all, the purveyor of the advice has to be aware of different impacts like the ones you described, and as well as the technology that's available to be able to promote. I saw a really interesting program run by AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, where they would do the following. It's kind of a circular thing. Groups of farmers would get together, and they wouldn't form a formal consortium. They'd just be together in order to kind of use peer information and peer pressure to support each other. They would then be advised by an agro dealer who had been trained by a U.S. kind of NGO, CNA, that does training. And they would train the agro dealer in a lot of the different kinds of issues that they need to know about, whether it's the seeds and the seed quality and the different kinds of seeds or the different implements to be able to use and the differences in fertilizer if necessary, and also what the different temperature impacts or lack of water or too much water we're going to do for them. Anyway, they would be trained in that as well as trained in business. And once they were certified, the agro dealer, they could give advice to the farmers. Then the banks got an incentive to loan to the farmers. And because often banks don't really want to make that agriculture loan, small-scale agriculture. So the banks had a guarantee that AGRA would pay them if the farmers didn't. And when they gave the loans, actually, the farmer would never get the money. If I was loaned $100 for seeds, as I drew down the seeds from the agro dealer would actually get the money from the bank, but I would still be responsible to pay it back. So I think we need to think creatively like that program, but many others, in order to bring advice to, especially to smallholder farmers, about how to work in this very complicated space that's becoming more complicated all the time.
Okay, we have a question here.
Ms. Bertini, thanks for coming. Could you talk to us about the procedures you set in place or were existent in the World Food Program to deal with the reality of local and governmental corruption in the receiving nations?
Sure. Corruption is a significant issue in a lot of places. I created a job of inspector general in the World Food Program. I remember I was at a meeting with a bunch of congressional staffers in Washington at one point, and I said this, and the guy said, "Well, who made you do that?" The staffer said, "Who made you do that?" I said, "Nobody." "Nobody? You created inspector general? Nobody made you?" I said, "No." We had to have some way to look into corruption and even concerns about what was going on, either whether it was the government, whether it was some other actor, or whether it was something wrong in our own system, and I needed an independent ability to be able to do that. The first year of existence of our inspector general, he got back about 10 times the amount of the investment that we put into his office. Because we finally had a way, when somebody had a concern somewhere, we finally had the professional who go check it out, rather than saying, "Oh, I've got this problem. Rosemary, would you go check out this problem?" "Well, yeah, but I used to work with Rosemary." No offense to Rosemary, but I mean, this is, you know, the way they do it. They just take somebody else that they think is okay, but not necessarily trained to do that. So that worked pretty well. But it's not end all or be all. I'll tell you, one time in one country, the country director said we were losing a lot of food. He could see these big bags of our food being sold in the market. And so the inspector went in, unannounced, got the police to go in with them, surrounded the market, and then the police arrested the guys when they were picking up their bags to run away. But I mean, a lot of things like that they tried to do. One time, one of our staff members went into a country store in one country in Africa and saw lots of, that's when we still had cans of fish that we gave out. We don't do that anymore. But anyway, he saw lots of WFP cans of fish on the shelf in the market. And he said, "Those for sale?" Owner said, "Yep." He said, "Well, can I buy some?" And he said, "Well, can I buy one?" And the store owner said, "One can or one case?" And so he bought a case, got a receipt, and then, of course, we not only shut it down there, but we shut down all of our food going into that country until the government held them accountable and told us what plan they were going to have in order to change it. The little problem there was the ambassador in Rome from that country was the niece of the owner of the store. but anyway, so there were a lot of, so we tried to do, then we had a program where we would do an assessment of missing food all along the way. So if we had more than 2% that we couldn't account for, then we would take corrective action. And if it became 5%, we'd stop it until we could find out where was the problem. We also had to deal with donors, too. One donor, one government said to us one time, "We have frozen beef that we want to give you for North Korea." Now, Stu's an expert in North Korea. We did a lot of work in North Korea because we started working there in 1995, and when we realized that the problem was much greater than a small area of agricultural land that had been hurt by bad weather, but it was really, really endemic crisis of hunger in North Korea. So we worked a lot in that country. But in any case, so this donor wanted to give us frozen beef to send to North Korea. So I said, "Have you ever seen that picture of the world at night? You ever seen that picture? Anybody here ever seen that picture? And you look at China and the Korean Peninsula, there's lots of lights except for in this one space where there's no lights. That's because there's not a lot of electricity in North Korea. So how would they keep this beef refrigerated? Or do you just want the government officials to get it anyway?" No. We want you to distribute. Well, we can't. We can't keep it there. But the other reason why we can't do it is because we have a policy that we will only take food that is essentially considered edible by the equivalent of the FDA in any given country, right? So if the FDA says the food is okay, it's okay for Americans, then all right, I can feed it to North Koreans or anybody else. But I said, "Why are you giving us that food?" Well, I knew why, but why? Because they had slaughtered their mad cows. So we had to deal with this government at all different levels trying to pressure us to take this food. They said, "Yes, but those people are starving." No. Anyway, long answer.
Okay, we have a question back here.
Again, thank you for being here. And I think my question kind of follows the first question with respect to science and the challenges of feeding 9 billion people by 2050. So the question I think is, from your experience in both development and hunger and the connections between the two, is it possible to continue to feed people and to feed a growing population without biotechnology? And if so, how does that work?
The answer is no. So I don't have to say how it works, because it doesn't work unless we use biotechnology. But to be more specific, over the long term, we have to be more productive. And we have to help farmers become more productive. They're really not much at all to do with biotechnology, but we also have to be able to expand where we can, and that's certainly shown to work. And this is one of those issues, though, about what's considered okay in the country of origin and what's not. And the U.S. and Canada, Australia, South Africa, India, China have a lot of products that are the result of some sort of biotech seed or something else. And all those countries have growing economies and growing agricultural economies and or strong agricultural economies. But I think that when we started promoting the U.S. started promoting a lot of new technologies, that we were a little bit arrogant about it. And we said, well, this is what we eat it, it's okay, so it's okay for you to eat. And a couple things happened. One was that Europeans didn't want to hear that. And, part of it was a kind of a traditional jockeying thing between the U.S. and Europe. But my view, having lived in Europe for 10 years, part of it was that Europeans are much more passionate about their food than Americans are. And, we'll go down to a fast food place on the way home and get something to eat, eat in the car so we can throw the package out when we get to our garbage can before we go in the house. Well, come on. You think an Italian would do that? The meal is a big thing, and everything, the family all sits around, and it takes a long time to eat, and they savor every piece of it. And the same is true in France, and you could name the countries in Europe where this people are emotional about their food. So I think we didn't pay attention to that. We collectively, early enough, in order to try to work through some of these issues together. And now there's African countries who don't want to have anything that's a new seed, for instance, because the Europeans have told them that they won't buy their agriculture production if any of it is GMO. So it's problematic. So that's one issue. Then the other issue is that some countries are still not convinced that it's safe. And right after I left the World Food Program, there was another drought in Southern Africa. And my successor, Jim Morris from Indiana, he was dealing with this problem. And both Zimbabwe and Zambia said they didn't want any more American corn, they didn't want to have any more genetically modified food to give to their folks. So when the World Food Program investigated further, they said, well, why? Well, the Zimbabweans said, well, we don't want any of your kernels of corn to migrate into our fields and potentially, change the character of our fields and to the point where then we can't sell to the Europeans. So WFP said, okay, well, what if we mill it and we give you ground corn? Okay, that's fine. So they took it. But the Zambians said, we have that issue too, but grinding it up isn't going to help any, because we don't buy this approach that this corn is okay in the U.S., so it's okay for us, because the percentage of our food that's corn-based is much higher than the American percentage of food. And where is your research that says that it's safe then? There wasn't any. So I'm trying to say, yes, we need it to feed the world, but we haven't finessed it very well in terms of showing that it's safe. And, you can't find a scientist who says it's not, but scientists aren't making all of these decisions. And we haven't well enough played it with our European brothers and sisters.
Okay.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. So working in the food bank industry for the past 4 years, I get approached fairly frequently with groups, organizations, other nonprofit agencies that do meal packing of bulk foods and distributions both here in the United States and also do maybe a little bit about what you talked about the World Food Program doing, dropping it in remote areas. Reversely, I've also heard a lot of critiques, especially when we've done these in the past, that these programs often bankrupt local farmers in those areas by an influx of free food, and then people then no longer buy food for a temporary amount of time, which then bankrupts these farmers. I hope you could maybe speak to that critique and see, tell me if there's what merit there is behind that.
Yes, first of all, it's really important wherever possible to buy food locally. And think about it from a World Food Program perspective. WFP is the largest purchaser of food in Africa, and largest, period. And so it supports a lot of the local production, but from big suppliers. So there are programs to try to help bring more experience and understanding to smallholder farmers about what they need to do in order to sell to organizations like the World Food Program or big commercial operations, because smallholder farmers don't have necessarily the sophistication, and they don't necessarily have storage facilities, they don't necessarily have any sort of system for receipts, they might want to sell to a middleman who comes along and offers them less price, but it's sooner than they would be paid by WFP. So they have to end up kind of learning how to operate the reliability system. But I want to go back to what I said about the origins of WFP. There's no more surplus. The U.S. and I think Japan are the only countries that still give in-kind food. The rest is cash. U.S. gives some cash, but the rest of the countries all give cash so that the food can be bought locally, if that's at all possible. And the same is true domestically, too. Anybody who's distributing food has to be very careful about understanding the sensitivities of the community where they're distributing it, and to try to accommodate those sensitivities. It's a case-by-case, neighborhood-by-neighborhood operation, but it's really very, very important to do so, because otherwise we undermine the basis on which we're trying to work.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions. Our first one's right here.
I just want to say thanks for coming as well, and I wanted to go back to a point you made earlier about speaking of the obesity epidemic in America, and specifically with young children and low-income families, and you know, being able to afford things when they can stop and get a burger for a dollar, but if they want to get an organic chicken breast and some fresh vegetables, you know, it'll cost $12. So how do we, you know, even it out where the healthier options can be comparable to the subsidized unhealthy options that can be purchased cheaper that are a lot more unhealthy?
Yeah, I think we have to be creative about that community by community, but I think the federal government and probably the state can do more too. This doesn't directly answer the chicken versus dollar burger thing, but let me give you a couple of suggestions. You know, we often talk about the food deserts in the inner cities where there are not enough stores, and you can go and see like a convenience store or a gas station that sells enough food so it can take food stamps and WIC, but it doesn't really sell healthy food. I've talked to some owners of some of the inner city stores who said, you know, it doesn't pay to keep healthy food like fruits and vegetables, for instance, in part because the people that come here shop when they get their SNAP benefits, and that's at the beginning of the month. And so why should I keep fruits and vegetables all month if nobody's, you know, it's only going to be sold for a few days? And so, you know, if you go year after year after year and you don't have any access to fruits and vegetables, well, they're just never part of your diet. The farmers markets are trying to deal with that, and you can use SNAP in most farmers markets. But we still need to address the grocery store issue. And I think that more can be done about staggering the benefits so that I could get mine SNAP on the first, and Bill gets his on the second, and Stu gets his on the third, and Maybe the grocery store would have a month-long customers and not everybody on the first day. The farmers' markets programs are important during the summer, but I don't know if you have here in Lawrence, but some communities are building indoor farmers' markets for the winter. And of course, not everything is going to be available, but it helps get into the culture of that fresh fruits and vegetables are good. And then, of course, the schools, because if children are used to eating in schools and eating meals that are healthy, then that makes a big difference as well if they get used to that. Once I visited Saudi Arabia when I was at WFP, and of course, interested in their making a donation. I wasn't successful at that time, and they often when you go to countries, they want to show you some interesting things in the country, and so they took me out to a 25,000 head dairy farm, and they were, and after we looked at the farm, then we had a discussion, and one of the my host was saying, we have to find more ways. Saudis don't drink a lot of milk, and we have to find ways to develop the milk, the dairy industry here in the market, especially because most of this is exported. And I said, well, I said, do you feed children in school? They said, yes. And I said, well, do you have milk at school? Put milk in the schools. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. Well, why not? Oh, because Pepsi-Cola already has the franchise. Anyway, I hope those are a few ideas, but over the long term, it is real. One other thing I want to mention, there's a movement called 1,000 Days. Has anybody heard about this? And Roger Thoreau, one of my colleagues at the Chicago Council, has written a book called 1,000 Days, where he followed young mothers in Chicago, Uganda, Guatemala, and India, and followed them from when they first became pregnant until their child was two, and writes about in this book about the different stories about what's happened and intersperses it with policy. But the 1,000-day movement is that the most important time in a child's life is from conception until age two, and that's when having the right kind of food available is more important than any other time in your life. And if you don't have it then you're not going to be able to develop as well as somebody who does, and that's a critical time, even in this country, to highlight good nutrition. But I don't think we can call it success when we still have so many Americans who really need this, food stamps, school lunches, and WIC benefits in order to have a chance to thrive. And we really need to do much more about that. But what better place to do it and to think about it and to try to strategize about what next steps would be than an institute named after Senator Bob Dole.
Kathy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's terrific.
You've just heard Catherine Bertini, winner of the 2003 World Food Prize. She spoke with Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute of Politics, on October 4th, 2017. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.